Okay, talking about an incident you just described, what was your attitude, your personal attitude at the time of this? Was it one of indifference? You couldn't change it? Was you happy for the white man who did this to the black man? Be honest if you can. Did you really care at the time?
I guess you could say my attitude varied during that time. At first, I was for the white folks. I was for the Klan in my heart because I felt like something was being forced down our throat that our culture had not accepted, did not want to do. And I thought a lot of out-of-town, out-of-state agitators caused our problems more so than how the people in my geographic Anniston, Calhoun County area might have felt about segregation, desegregation. I am sure that Anniston would have gone to a desegregated, integrated group or a mix within time. I felt like that we were just being pressed, and it was a point that it was sort of the Klan and a lot of other there was another you don't hear much about them now, but there was another society called the John Birch Society. The John Birch Society was a conservative group formed that was not as rabble-rouser as Ku Klux Klan, but they held for the rights of individuals and more like the rights of white folks. And the John Birchers, they would come up and they'd have a meeting at the courthouse and they'd try to get people to contribute money, and I'd listen to them every now and then. But as I grew older and matured, I realized that this was something that the South cannot hold on to, and my opinion towards segregation went from a staunch supporter of segregation to indifference about segregation to later on acceptance of integration.
Okay. I'm going to shift a little bit. Now, we're trying to still stay in your high school era.
Mm-hmm.
You say you graduated in 1962.
Yes.
That era we was in Vietnam. We were sending, what I know, we were sending mostly what's the word I'm looking for? Advisors.
Advisors, that's a good word.
In 1962. I don't believe we had any troops. I was talking about the advisors and everything. What was, in the community you lived in, the mass opinions that were felt about the war in general, and reflect them with, say, your personal feelings?
All right.
If they differed, were they the same?
Well, really, we're taking a jump from graduation of high school to Vietnam. Didn't really make the American news scene, and it wasn't talked about much until 1965-66. Even though we were over there in the advisor capacity in the early 60s, as you mentioned, Banya, maybe from 63 on, the big troop movements, the large troop units, divisions, and so forth, went over in the 65 time frame. That's when I was in Auburn. I was in ROTC at Auburn in that time frame. And I don't know if prior to 65 or 66, if anybody in Austin really gave a damn. There wasn't a lot of kids from this area that was in the service that had gone to Vietnam in the early 60s. I remember there were not any protests or anything like that at Auburn because, one, Auburn was a conservative school. There were a lot of ROTC folks there. I joined ROTC in 62, and I went advanced ROTC in 64. In 64, I think, well, we might have known a little bit about Vietnam, but it wasn't talked about too much. Just some kind of little police action, you know, where we had 1,000 or so folks over there. And then 65, when the body counts on the American boys started going up, well, I started studying on TV about various types of protests. But as far as protesting at Auburn about the war, I don't even remember any. In fact, I remember blood drives that we would have for the casualties in Vietnam, because Fort Benning was just 30 miles from Auburn. So Auburn was sort of like a pro-army type university or you know, pro-support over there.
Okay. Well, you said you've already answered that. You about to answer this. Did you have any friends that were gung-ho for the war while you was in high school, or most of them really not give a damn? They, like, after high school, joined the war, joined the army for the purpose of stopping communism in Southeast Asia?
I lost contact with my high school friends by going to Auburn. When you go to school 100 miles away, you lose contact with them, and you start, you know, your new friendships at your university. I know of a couple of boys that joined the service. I don't know if they were gung-ho for communism or just didn't have a job or what the situation was. One of my early childhood friends I mentioned earlier, I went to grammar school with in high school, Luther Owen. Luther quit after 2 years at Auburn. Well, he flunked out, but he quit. Hell, he just partied and drank too much beer down there. And he joined the Marine in 64 and stayed in the Marine. He might even join in 63 until the late 60s, and he was coming back to school in 66 when I was graduating. He was a sophomore as far as the academic classification. But I didn't have many friends that I remembered that joined the armed services as any patriotic movement. The anti-war movement was not prevalent in Alabama because, one, Alabama was a conservative state, pro-military, had a lot of military installations around or in Alabama, and it was till some people started getting killed that in your hometown, your area, the people started noticing the activities of anti-war going on in up north. I'll jump around a little bit to tell you when I thought I had made a mistake. When I graduated from Auburn in 1966, I was commissioned as second lieutenant. I did not go on active duty right then. I had requested a deferment on active duty so I could work a little bit and make a little money. So my family situation had changed at that time. My parents became divorced when I was in college, and I didn't have that middle class income to support me as I did early in school. And so when I was fortunate enough to graduate from college, I was like a lot of folks, I didn't have a dime, and I wanted to make enough money to at least buy a car and have a few dollars in the bank before I went in service. And about this time in the 66-67 time frame, the TV networks really got busy with sending correspondents to Vietnam, and daily you could see the fighting, you could see people getting shot, you could see the bombings, and you knew, like I knew, I was going over there, and I just know what in the hell for? You know, what are we doing over there? I would read Time magazine and Newsweek and see how little kids in Vietnam who, for whatever reason, the Viet Cong, North Vietnamese, had got their allegiance and read stories where they would bring some type of bombs or booby traps into American area. And American boys would get killed by a child, by a 6-7 year old child, and this child would die too. He wouldn't know he was carrying a live hand grenade into an area. And so, I mean, everything just went upside down. Nobody knew what the hell was fighting for. Nobody said, well, we're going to conquer Vietnam, we're going to make Vietnam another state. You know, we'll fly the flag over there. All I could ever figure out, well, we'd fight at one rice paddy, then go to another rice paddy. We saw the Viet Cong, and we'd just fight them where they were. We didn't have any plan to systematically eradicate the enemy, as far as I could tell.
Did this right here, did this lack of a plan that you saw, this kind of make you down in the United States and you wanting to serve in the military? Did it like mess up your previous reasons why you even joined the army?
Well, it scared the hell out of me. Mainly, I could just see me going over there and not coming back, because I had some friends at Auburn at this time who I knew in ROTC. I remember when I got out of school, I worked here and that. And when they got out of school, they went right on in the service. And so in 67 and early 68, I was receiving correspondence about them from Vietnam. And had a good friend of mine in Nashville, Tennessee, Larry Beadle. Larry was with a armored cavalry unit over there. And armored cavalry units were sort of like scouts, more or less. So they took care of your flanks of the unit, of the army. And Larry would write me and tell me how he didn't sleep much at night, because, you know, just wondering if he was going to wake up the next day. And then in practice, and all the army training, you'd always ride inside a personnel carrier. Personnel carrier was like a 10-foot long by 10-foot wide track vehicle that would carry 12 men. It had a door in the back of it. You'd go in the door, go inside the vehicle, and whenever you got to your place of discharge, you'd open the door and get out. Well, I found out they didn't even travel in that vehicle like that in Vietnam, because it was aluminum construction, this personnel carrier was. And when they would go over landmines, the discharge was just such a magnitude, it would blow that aluminum just to smithereens, and anybody inside, you know, was automatically killed. And Larry wrote me and told me that the way you travel on personnel carrying Vietnam, everybody rode on top. Nobody rode inside of it. They would even take the risk of taking sniper fire by riding on top of the personnel carrier, having sandbags, sit on sandbags on top of personnel carrier, because they hit a mine, at least you'd have to go through the bottom and the top and the sandbags before it hit anybody. So everybody was just scared to death they were going to get killed over there, and nobody knew what the hell for. I mean, all you knew is that you had a good chance of getting killed, and nobody really knew what for.
Okay.